President Trump pulls out his executive pen on health care.
We are going to have great health care in our country. We're taking a little different route than we had hoped.
Allies react to the president's Iran deal decision.
We think the Iranians are in compliance with it. And as long as they're in compliance with it, we support it.
And conservatives target Republican leaders.
It's a failure. It's a failure on a policy level.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. The power of the presidency is sometimes wielded with a pen.
I'm going to be working with Congress where I can to accomplish this. But I'm also going to act on my own if Congress is deadlocked. I've got a pen to take executive actions where Congress won't. And I've got a telephone to rally folks around the country on this mission.
Well, now that pen belongs to President Trump, and this week he used it along with his Twitter account to roll back cornerstone priorities of his predecessor.
This order takes first steps to make it easier for businesses to help their workers afford high quality and more flexible health care through reimbursement accounts.
One executive order signed by President Trump in an Oval Office ceremony is supposed to allow employers of small businesses to band together across state lines to offer health plans that don't meet Affordable Care Act requirements. Supporters say it offers more choice and access to lower-priced insurance options. Critics say it relaxes standards for health care plans and will raise rates for older and sicker Americans and destabilize insurance markets. Those same critics are far more worried about a second executive action taken by President Trump. His administration will no longer pay subsidies to insurance companies designed to offset higher premiums.
It's step by step by step. And that was a very big step yesterday. Another big step was taken the day before yesterday. And one by one, it's going to come down and we're going to have great health care in our country.
President Trump won praise at the Conservative Values Voter Summit in D.C., but Democrats are accusing the president of deliberately sabotaging the Affordable Care Act by taking action that will increase premiums on millions of Americans. In a tweet following the announcement, President Trump called the subsidies payments to pet insurance companies, telling Democrats to call him to fix it. Those subsidies are called cost-sharing reduction payments, or CSRs, a contentious issue among lawmakers for years. House Republicans even sued the Obama administration, arguing they violate separation of power since Congress, and not the president, controls the power of the purse. That legal rationale is how the Trump administration is explaining its decision. Attorney General Jeff Sessions arguing courts found the appropriation must come from Congress, and the president cannot make those payments. Congress has been trying to find the fix, and in the weeks leading up to the failed Graham-Cassidy repeal bill, the top Republican and Democrat on the Senate Health Committee were making progress on legislation that would authorize from Congress those subsidy payments. The issue is now destined to return. Congress will have to pass an all-encompassing spending bill in December to avoid a government shutdown. Those CSR payments will be a major issue for Democrats, who Republican leaders will need to pass a spending bill in the Senate. Healthcare isn't the only area the Trump administration is using the same tools as the last White House. Earlier this week, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt began a process to rescind the Clean Power Plan, an Obama-era regulation limiting emissions for coal-fired power plants.
They were using every bit of power, every bit of authority to use the EPA to pick winners and losers in how we generate electricity in this country.
Much of the Clean Power Plan was blocked by federal courts. So were some of the health care initiatives pushed by the Obama administration. And just as President Obama was challenged in court when he used the presidential pen, opposition groups are already mounting legal fights over action President Trump is taking with his executive pen. As much as President Trump can use his executive pen to reshape aspects of the health care law, he'll need Congress for another top priority, tax reform. Republicans insist they'll have a tax code rewrite in the Oval Office by the end of the year, a plan they say that will save Americans money, simplify how you pay taxes, and intensify economic growth. How realistic is the goal, and how far along are lawmakers really at achieving something that hasn't been done in 30 years? Here's what our senior Capitol Hill producer Chad Pergram and I are hearing.
The big topic here on Capitol Hill all week and probably for the next several weeks, Chad, is tax reform in this pretty ambitious timeline that Republican leaders are sticking to. By the end of the year, we heard from Speaker Ryan on Thursday say he'll keep people here through Christmas if need be. Is that a realistic expectation based on what we have learned over the last couple of days, particularly from the key tax writing committees like House Ways and Means?
Well, no one was really thinking that this was going to get done right away anyway. It takes a while because they don't have specifics. No one knows what those specifics will look like, and then it will take some a period of time for people to sort of parse that and see if it works in their district, if it works in their state. And until you get to that point, even if they were ready to go now, and say they had the votes, we're looking at maybe the first week of November, but they're nowhere ready to go. So that puts it to Christmas anyway. And the speaker using Christmas, this is this old time-honored tradition here on Capitol Hill. We're threatening, to keep everybody until Christmas. They're not going to get home to trim the tree, do all the honeydew projects, go to the store. We hear this all the time. And so that isn't a surprise. But what it also does is it helps Ryan say we're going to do this year. He has said consistently we want to do it this year, although some people say this could bleed into next year. And remember that the 1986 tax reform bill, the last time they tackled this in a major fashion, was completed about 30 days before the midterm election. So there's nothing to say you can't do it, quote, in an election year.
Some key differences, though. That 1986 bill, I believe, passed through a voice vote in the House, and the vote was overwhelming in the Senate.
It was pretty overwhelming in the
Senate.
That's
not the expectation with the 2017-2018 effort.
And therein lies the rub, especially in the United States Senate. They're going to use this special process, or at least try to use this special process again, called budget reconciliation. They have adopted a budget in committee. It has not moved to the Senate floor yet. They've moved it in the House. And you need budget reconciliation so you can extinguish a filibuster. It takes 60 votes to turn off a filibuster. There's no way they're going to get 60 votes. I think they had 97 votes in the Senate in 1986. So you're going to squeak this thing through with 51, 52 votes, maybe even a 50-50 vote with Vice President Pence. You might not even have all the Republicans on board. There is a theory that maybe you could land a couple of moderate Democrats who are facing competitive elections in battleground states next time around. You could see a coalition coming together there where it has just a sheath of bipartisanship, but it's still pretty narrow, and that's why people are very skeptical that this gets done at all.
To that point, we have talked a lot about how the specifics are going to matter. People want sort of a side-by-side comparison. Here's what my tax liability is under current law. Here's what my tax liability would be under this tax reform plan. That's going to be the tough sell, not just in the Senate, in the House as well, as we've talked about certain deductions that may go. The big one that we keep hearing again and again about is this eliminating of the state and local tax deduction. That is a big deal for members from New York, a big deal for members of New Jersey, California, a sizable enough group of Republicans who could sink, before it got very far, any sort of tax reform process.
It all comes back to the mathematics. And you look at Dan Donovan, who is a moderate Republican from Staten Island and part of Brooklyn. He's very concerned about how this impacts New York, a high tax state. You know, I think there's 13, 14 Republicans from the California delegation. Well, you know, when you can only lose, 19, 20 votes in the House of Representatives on this, and if you're going to lose all the Californians from a state like that, you're in trouble. Now, that's not to say they will lose every last one, but that's a big chunk right there. You could also probably lose some from the Freedom Caucus. Because this isn't, saving money. You know, we don't know what it does to deficits. And that's why, you look at the size of the state and local deduction. That's about $1.3 trillion out of a package that's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $6.5 trillion. So even if they change that, that's not the end of the world. But I think that the trick here is going to be getting something that enough people can agree upon. That's always the trick in Congress. Who takes the hurt and votes for it, even though it's not quite right for the district, or who then holds back because it's not right for the district and then they don't have the votes to pass the bill on the floor?
We got a bit of an update on where they are in the process this week from the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady, a Republican from Texas. Here's a little bit of what he said.
Every day as we've looked at these ideas and solutions, we really come, I think, to better, more improved in every area, on the family side, on the business side. in how we can become competitive worldwide. All this is complicated, as you know, and just takes time to work through those options and in the scores as well. So I just feel good about the direction we're going and the pace that we're going.
So what you hear from that, Chad, is sort of the same talking points that we've heard from a few weeks now. Here's the framework. Here's what we want to accomplish. We still don't have an awful lot of specifics. When do they start filling in these blanks?
Well, you and I were in that same scrum with Kevin Brady outside his hovel from the Ways and Means Committee off the House floor. And what was remarkable is that there was a reporter who tried to nail him down, saying, you know, you keep, coming out with these bromides every week and saying we're making progress. And the reporter said, you know, what are the specifics? Give me some concrete areas of where the progress is. And he couldn't do it. And that's where the devil will be in the details. We will know more probably toward the end of next week, because the Senate has to adopt a budget. If the Senate stumbles in adopting a budget, that's a problem. This process probably, you talk about this Christmas, you might be on to next Christmas. That's the situation there.
Again, because of that reconciliation, that's why passing a budget is critical in the Senate.
Right. But, if you haven't adopted a budget, well, that thing hasn't expired yet. So that gives them maybe a little more time next year if they really get sideways on this. But at the end of the day, you will know the signpost to look for that this thing is really starting to move is after the Senate adopts its budget. So you have that option in the Senate to avoid a filibuster. Number two is that the Ways and Means Committee schedules a markup session. A markup session is where they go through the bill line by line. And when you know that they have actually scheduled that, that tells you that Kevin Brady, the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, thinks they have the votes in committee. Now, not on the floor. But if they fail on this, remember just a few days ago, the U.S. men's national soccer team lost to Trinidad and Tobago and failed to qualify for the World Cup. One of the most epic losses in sports history, any sport. Republicans, this is going to be like them losing and failing to qualify for the World Cup if they don't get tax reform done, considering their debacle on health care.
For Republican leaders, the stakes could not be any higher on passing tax reform. Conservative activists, including former White House advisor Steve Bannon, are growing more and more frustrated by what they see as little to show for Republican control of the House, Senate, and White House. So much so, several grassroots leaders this week in Washington called for Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and his leadership team in the Senate to step down. Ken Cuccinelli is the former Attorney General in Virginia and now leads the Senate Conservatives Fund, charged with the mission of getting conservatives elected to the Senate, even if that means taking on sitting Republicans. They are claiming a recent victory, too, in Alabama, where former Judge Roy Moore knocked off Senator Luther Strange, despite Strange's backing by Senate GOP leaders and President Trump. I spoke with Cuccinelli to get a sense of where his and he says a lot of conservatives' frustrations rest.
What is your message here for the majority leader?
I mean, our message is you're way past some discussion about what it would take to be appropriate to stay. That's why the call to step down and the whole leadership team. I mean, he has been consistent for many years in his actions, behavior, strategy, et cetera. And it's a failure. It's a failure on a policy level, as we're seeing this year. I mean, Mitch McConnell set the conditions. Just get me a Republican Senate. Just get me a Republican House. Just get me a Republican president. And we'll do all these things we all promised in our campaigns. Well, they've done virtually none of them. And they are hardly putting even in effort. They've approved seven judges, seven. That's less than one a month since Trump assumed office. There are 50 awaiting votes and over 100 vacancies on the bench. The failure on Obamacare repeal is legendary.
Cuccinelli argues McConnell's inability to corral 50 votes on health care is because GOP leadership has backed the wrong candidates or focused on the wrong races.
In 2016... there were two U.S. Senate seats, Nevada and Colorado, that were held by Democrats flippable to Republicans. When Darrell Glenn, a conservative Air Force Academy veteran and Air Force Academy graduate and Air Force veteran, twice elected in Colorado, ran an outstanding grassroots primary contest, but beat McConnell's chosen candidate, who frankly collapsed. They refused to support him simply because he was conservative. And how do we know that? Because they put $25 million into supporting the mushy moderate Rhino Republican in Nevada, and zero into Colorado, and both candidates lost by 3 points. So Colorado was always a better shot to win, and they refused to support him because he was conservative. Mitch McConnell can't blame other people for being short one vote when he made sure that vote isn't there.
Moving forward, Cuccinelli says the Senate Conservatives Fund is looking at potential primary challenges to a few Republicans. He specifically named Jeff Flake in Arizona, Dean Heller in Nevada, Orrin Hatch in Utah, and Roger Wicker in Mississippi. So I asked, is this infighting good for the Republican Party?
Do you worry about a party split, a third party emerging?
You know, if that were easy to do, we'd have done it a long time ago. But the two party
really, you think system, you would have left the Republican Party?
I tell people I'm a Republican because they're wrong less. It's humorous and it's accurate. They so consistently, the elected Republicans so consistently go a direction different than that which they campaigned on. Yeah, the majority of the Republican Party, forget elected official and everything else, believes that Obamacare ought to be completely repealed, believes in tax cuts, not tax reform, i.e. reshuffling the chair on the deck of the Titanic to help K Street. They believe in getting this 20-week abortion bill through, the pain-capable bill. There is a terrible undercurrent within the party right now that is different from the anger over Obamacare and everything else. Now it is turned this year because they've seen that the leadership, especially in the Senate, is not with them.
It should be noted, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was reelected to lead Republicans by acclamation last year with a standing ovation, his spokesman noted at the time, with no other Senate Republican publicly considering a challenge. So we've talked about the legislative to-do list for Congress, health care, DACA, tax reform, and now add to it the future of a comprehensive international agreement designed to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. President Trump on Friday took a middle road approach to the future of the Iran deal, stopping short of withdrawal, but instead decertifying compliance, arguing Iran has not lived up to the spirit of the agreement.
While the United States adheres to our commitment under the deal, the Iranian regime continues to fuel conflict, terror, in turmoil throughout the Middle East and beyond.
One of the signatories to the nuclear deal is Great Britain, one of the so-called P5 plus one nations that negotiated the agreement. Our White House correspondent John Decker spoke with the British ambassador to the U.S., Ken Derrick, about the allies' take on the Iran deal.
We support this deal. We think it's very much in our national security interests. We think that it has imposed some quite severe restrictions on the Iranian nuclear program. So we believe that they're in compliance at the moment.
If the president decides to walk away from the deal or attempts to increase pressure on Iran to negotiate better terms, why isn't that a good thing for the world community?
Well, look, we agree with the president and the administration about the malign and unacceptable nature of Iranian activities in the region, what they're doing in Syria, in the Lebanon, in Yemen. And we are already talking to the administration, very keen to work with them on pushing back on all of that. But in terms of the nuclear deal, we regarded this as an important deal for our national security. As I've said, we think the Iranians are in compliance with it. And as long as they're in compliance with it, we support it.
The president, on numerous occasions, I'm sure you're aware, Mr. Ambassador, has called this one of the worst deals he's ever seen. What's wrong with trying to get all of the various countries that were involved in putting together this particular agreement, getting them together and trying to renegotiate the agreement?
To be honest with you, we think that that for our, in terms of our national security, our perceptions of our national security, this was a good deal for us. It imposed severe restrictions on Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium, severe restrictions on the number of centrifuges they had. It closed down their heavy water reactor, and it has imposed the most intensive inspection regime on Iran's nuclear program, really, of any inspection regime in history. So that's why we support it. But as I've said, we're very keen to work with the administration. We've been talking to them for a while about ways of countering what Iran is doing in the region. And so we look forward to developing a strategy with this administration on that, but alongside the JCPOA.
The agreement discouraged, but it did not explicitly prohibit Iran from continuing to develop its ballistic missile program. Is that problematic to the British government?
Yeah, obviously we don't like the idea of Iran developing a ballistic missile capability. It's not part of the JCPOA, and as I've said, we'd like to preserve the JCPOA. But of course, we're interested in ways of countering that aspect of Iranian activity as well.
The president, besides announcing whether or not he'll certify whether Iran is complying with the multinational agreement, he's also expected to lay out plans to crack down on Iran's missile program and its support for Hezbollah and other militant groups in the Middle East. Are these ideas that the U.S. and Great Britain are on the same page?
Yeah, look, we absolutely agree that what Iran is doing in Lebanon with Hezbollah, in Syria, in supporting the Assad regime, in Yemen, in supporting the Houthis, that these are all unacceptable and destabilizing activities. And as I say, we've been talking to the administration for a while now about ways in which we can counter this, and ways in which we can push back on Iran. So absolutely, that's something we're interested in taking forward and working with the administration on.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, the president is likely to designate the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is Iran's elite military branch, as a terrorist organization. And Iran is vowing what it calls a crushing response if the U.S. takes that step. Do you think that's destabilizing to the region in any way if the president decides to do just that?
Let me be clear. We don't like what the IRGC is doing around the region. We think it's destabilizing, it's damaging, it's supporting extremism and terrorism, and it's unacceptable. So we're keen to work with the administration on ways of combating all of that, and we have ideas of pushing back, of how to push back, and as I say, we will work with the administration on those.
Is it your belief that the best deal was negotiated at that time, that all the pressure that could have been brought to bear on Iran was indeed brought to bear on Iran at that time by all the parties involved?
Yeah, we're signatories to the deal. It took on and off some 12, 13 years to negotiate. It took a huge amount of effort. So, yes, we were parties to it, and we believed that it was the best deal that could be done at the time, and that because of what it has, its impact on an Iranian nuclear program that was very close to breakout at the time that we secured the deal, that it's very much in our national security interest to keep it.
And is it your understanding, Mr. Ambassador, that regardless of what the president announces in just a few hours, Iran will abide by terms of that multilateral agreement?
Well, let's see what Congress decides to do if, as we expect, there is a role for Congress in following up the president's announcement. But certainly, we would hope that Iran would stick with the deal, as we intend to ourselves.
And one final thing I must ask you, and that is, I realize you're a diplomat. That's your responsibility. At the same time, are you in any way troubled by the idea that the U.S. is going it essentially alone on this particular issue. They're not sticking together with the rest of those countries that helped negotiate the 2015 multinational agreement.
You know, we hugely value our cooperation with the United States and with this administration on all aspects of international policy. And our hope is that we will continue to be able to cooperate closely on addressing all of the international problems and challenges we face together.
British Ambassador to the United States, Kim Darroch, thank you so much for coming on Fox News Radio. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. You too.
That will do it for this edition of the From Washington podcast. Senate Republicans return to tax reform next week, intent on passing a critical budget. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions is sure to get grilled on DACA, sanctuary cities, and Affordable Care Act subsidies when he testifies for the Judiciary Committee. If you like what you're hearing, you can also subscribe to the From Washington podcast on Apple Podcast. And as always, the news breaks fast both in and out of Washington, so be sure to stay tuned to your Fox News Radio affiliate, as well as our social media pages on Twitter and Facebook for updates on the latest stories. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern. From Washington.